Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Back in 2008, the death of a Wisconsin girl made headlines here and around the country when it was revealed that her family had foregone medical treatment for diabetes in favor of faith healing. That story and the questions it raised provide some of the backdrop for the latest novel by writer Nicholas Butler. Little Faith is set in a small fictional town in western Wisconsin, not too far from Butler's real home in Eau Claire.
It is told through the experiences of 65-year-old Lyle Hovde, who is generally content with his life and his role as a retiree, grandfather, and occasional apple harvester. The book plays out over the seasons of a year and leads Lyle and readers to ask some deep but fundamental questions about the nature of faith and religion. Nick Butler joins us in the studio now to answer some fundamental questions about the new novel. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Nice to see you again. I'm happy to be back.
It's great to see you again, and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I feel pretty lucky to live the life that I live and to publish these books, and I'm pretty proud of this one. I think it does what I wanted it to do. So,
well, let's start with that. What were you hoping it would do?
Well, I had kind of two ideas. One was to sort of, you know, I had been kind of influenced a little bit by this sort of true crime case that happened back in 2008, where a young girl died of complications of diabetes because her parents were praying for her rather than seeking medical treatment. So that was one thing that I researched prayer healing in America a whole lot. But I began thinking that would be a really dark book if that's what the only sort of narrative thrust was. So I started thinking that a way to kind of camouflage that or toggle that would be to write a story about a grandpa and his grandson and that kind of amazingly sweet, special relationship between the very old and the very young, and trying to braid those two stories together. So,
yeah, well, and I was hoping to kind of get into who Lyle is pretty early, because it's really through his experiences that we watch this story unfold. Lyle seems to be about the most decent person you could imagine, maybe the guy we all sort of hope we might be when we're 65.
Yeah, well, so Lyle is not based on my father-in-law, Jim, but he's certainly inspired by my father-in-law. And I'd known Jim, I should also say, I've known Jim since I was about 12 years old. But I think after I got married, I realized that because he has juvenile diabetes, his family had always sort of looked at his lifespan as, you know, like when he was a younger man, they told him he might not live past 50. So I started to write. I wrote a short story called Apples, which is in my short story collection, and it's about a character named Lyle. And basically, I wanted to kind of preserve the memory of who this guy was and what he means to his family and to his community. And that character had always kind of hung around. And then I just decided, like, well, I can riff off my own work. That's fine. I'm not stealing from anyone. So I wanted to write this novel that was about him and kind of celebrating his spirit. Yeah, I think a lot of us, after we pass away, I wonder whether anyone's going to remember us. But one way to preserve a person's memory or spirit is in a book and in fiction. So that was certainly one of the goals here, too.
Well, and I wonder, and he's obviously not here to speak for himself, but someone who deals with such a serious illness for presumably such a long time has to have a certain outlook on life. It's the kind of thing that can either make one extremely bitter for their whole life or extremely grateful and giving, and it sounds like he's the latter.
Yeah, he's, you know, you said like that Lyle is an almost unbelievably good guy. And when you meet my father-in-law, Jim, he's like that, too. He's just incredibly helpful and kind. And the longer that I live and the longer that I live near him, the more people that I meet whom he has influenced positively. You know, he just like he'll volunteer to go fix somebody's kitchen sink or their dishwasher or something like that. And he never wants anything in return. And he's not doing it for selfish reasons. He's just that kind of person. And, you know, frankly, I don't know that we read a lot of fiction where there's characters like that, but that doesn't mean that they don't exist in the real world.
I mean, did you worry about making him too decent?
No. No, because he, you know, one way that we see who he is as a full human being and in an honest way is the fact that he really struggles with his faith, that he's in some ways angry with God.
Well, right. And so Lyle in the book dealt from a long time ago with the loss of an infant.
Yeah.
How would you describe Lyle's approach to spirituality by the time he was 65?
Yeah. Well, I think I almost want to have like a glossary of terms because, you know, there's like spirituality and religiosity. There's all these sort of different belief terms. But I think Lyle believes in something beyond the plane of normal human existence, but he can't quite go into believing that there's like a God in the clouds, and he can't quite believe in the Bible. He can't quite believe in church. So I think, you know, and not to sound like New Agey or anything like that, but he sees beauty in the natural world. He sees beauty in the orchard that he works in and the seasons and in his grandson. But he really is jaded on organized religion. If that makes sense.
I wonder if, would you be willing to read maybe a little bit of the start to chapter 5, which
yep.
is kind of where we start to understand really who Lyle is and where he's coming from when it comes to faith or spirituality or religiosity or God.
Sure.
And yeah, I don't know, maybe read till it seems natural to stop reading.
Okay. Although Lyle had stopped believing, he never really stopped attending church. Indeed, he often suspected he was not alone in this, that many millions of Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Taoists, and Mormons all around the world attended their churches, temples, and mosques as much out of routine or obligation as out of any real fervor or belief. Or perhaps to model a new dress or hat, a new pair of shoes, or a sharp suit. Guilt, he supposed, must also have played a role, for certainly not every butt in a pew was doing the Lord's work 24/7. Some might secretly be cheating on their taxes, sleeping with the neighbor's wife or husband, playing the casino slot machines or roulette tables with the children's college fund, or who knew what other litany of shortcomings from the trivial to the criminal. For others, it might be boredom or loneliness. But for Lyle, so much depended on his childhood friend, Pastor Charlie, and that lovely old country church in which he had spent so many Sundays as a child, shuffled into that hard-backed pew by his now long-departed parents.
Nicholas Butler reading from A Little Faith. You mentioned the kind of true crime story that undergirds at least part of this tale. Mm-hmm. Was that the catalyst that got you thinking about faith, God, religion, whatever we want to call it, or is there something there? Were you thinking about it in other ways already?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think I've been thinking a lot about it personally. When we when my wife and I moved back to Eau Claire, we returned to our childhood Lutheran church, the church we both grew up in, matriculated through, you know, communion and confirmation classes and all that good stuff. And we kind of wanted to give our children that same sort of infrastructure, spiritual infrastructure that we grew up with. The trouble is that I don't really believe in God. So here I am, you know, not every Sunday. I'm not going to claim to have perfect church attendance because I don't really care. But I'm sitting in my church just thinking, like, what am I doing here? And what am I getting out of this? And trying to believe in something, you know, I think allowing myself to be open to some supernatural being finding me. But nothing ever takes.
And there's kind of one point where I think it's I forget who Lyle's talking with, maybe to Hoot, his old friend, or it might have been to Pastor Charlie. But he's basically saying, you know, as long as everybody's kind of good to each other and does right by each other, and, you know, whether we call it religion or not, it seems to be the way you live your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I agree with that, though. I think for me, good writing is not judgmental, right? You're trying to not be judgmental about your characters that you create. You're hopefully looking to understand more about the way that people in the real world make their decisions and live their lives, and also how your fictional characters do that. And I mean, I've met people in my life that really, really believed, and I'm not trying to mock anyone who believes at all. I'm very curious about that. And I've met people whose lives were changed for the better by believing or being reborn or something like that. So, you know, when I handed this book into my agent, he really loved it. And he's a tough critic, but he said, man, nobody's really writing this book right now. And I didn't even think about that because I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop and Marilyn Robinson was a teacher there and Jim McPherson, people who, you know, write a lot about spirituality. But I just don't think it's very sort of in vogue right now. It's a little bit taboo. It's, you know, I think a lot of people think maybe it's even old fashioned, but to me, it's one of the universal questions about us as human beings. What happens to us after we die? Is there a soul that goes somewhere else? And so I was really interested in it.
There's really, and you know, I never want to give too much away, but there's a point at which Lyle is called on to help pray for somebody, and he can't do it. And it's a really heartbreaking scene because I think on its face it's heartbreaking, but you can see how much that inability is kind of tearing him up inside.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, Lyle is 25 years older than I am, I guess, or 26 years older than I am, but we obviously share some similarities. I wouldn't be able to write him if there wasn't part of me there. And I mean, those Sundays when I'm sitting in church and everybody else is praying, my eyes have always been open, and I just have a really difficult time sort of letting go. And it is hard, you know. I mean, when you're in a community like that of people who really fervently believe, and it seems to give them some sort of grace or solace, and you don't really feel that. I don't know. It's odd.
Are your fellow parishioners aware of the book you've written?
I don't know. I don't know. I just try to, you know. I think the quick answer to that is I don't know. You know, I choose to live in my hometown because nobody treats me differently. So I just sort of move along not thinking about stuff.
You talk about not being judgmental in writing, and there's a character in this book. He's a sort of a charismatic preacher who moves into Eau Claire, I think, or La Crosse.
Right.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
But and it would be really easy to caricature him, but you seem to go to great lengths to give him some, you know, deep down redeeming characteristics. Redeeming probably being the wrong choice of words here.
Yeah, well, I mean, if a book's going to have a character that could sort of be identified as a villain, I think the work of a writer is to try and figure out how that person came to be a villain. And you know, in preparation for this book, I read a lot about faith healing and prayer healing. And I also just listened to some pretty fringe pastors, like on YouTube, and also listening to my AM radio dial every day. And when I'm driving across rural Wisconsin, I'd listen to stuff. And I'm not picking on anyone. I'm not being judgmental. Part of it was trying to get inside to understand, okay, well, you know, what makes up this opinion, this group of beliefs? And you know, I mean, I'm hopeful that people, atheists, agnostics, Buddhists, Jews, Christians, read this book. So I'd be kind of foolish to be making fun of anyone or to be, you know, making clear villains.
This is a strange way to ask this question. Not so long ago, I'm gonna name drop another writer here, and that's Leif Enger, who wrote this pretty wonderful book called Virgil Wander. And I was struck by two reviews of it that I read. Mm-hmm. One was by Ron Charles in the Washington Post, mm-hmm. and the other was by you in the New York Times.
Yeah.
And reading it, I got the sense that there are some people who get characters from small towns in the Midwest, mm-hmm. and there are some people who do not, and those people are often on the coasts. Mm-hmm. So I guess in an extremely roundabout way, the people who inhabit Little Faith are not so different than the people who inhabit Virgil Wander.
Yeah.
You know, Lyle and Peg, but also Charlie and Hoot and Shiloh and others. Mm-hmm. Do you think these are familiar people? Are you in some strange way an ambassador to what real people are like for you know, those of us in flyover country to people on the coasts?
Yeah.
Wow, that was a long question.
Geez, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that this book could easily be set in, I don't know, upstate New York, rural Virginia, a lot of different places, Northern California, the Wyoming and Colorado that I just traveled through. There's a lot of places where I know these characters exist. What you asked is a tough question. And, you know, I really enjoyed a lot of Leif Enger's book. It was a difficult book to review because it was a comedy. and it was filled with magical realism. And I tried as hard as I could in that. I loved it. Let me just say that. It was filled with clearly a lot of the author's passions. And I think when you're writing fiction, you should be rewarded for that. But one thing I was struck by that Washington Post review is that it didn't seem like the reviewer took any time to try and understand what the writer was doing. It was kind of a lazy review. And in some ways, it was a little bit mean-spirited. And that's what kind of struck me about it. That was a book full of really kind characters, and some of them were magical. They were different. They were stepping out of like a mist almost, you know, and flying kites in storms. It wasn't really meant to be like a perfect representation of northern Minnesota, I don't think. And I tried with this book to modulate light and dark. There's a lot of happy stuff here. There's a lot of stuff that I think is the upside of living in a beautiful place without a lot of people. But there's a dark side, too, and that's that these small towns are dying and that sometimes the people that live in those small towns are susceptible to, this evangelist.
That
was a long-winded answer.
That was a long-winded question, though. So, well, and really, to your point, I got the sense that the Post reviewer, saw rural Minnesota and immediately conjured up Garrison Keillor in his mind.
I think they mentioned Garrison Keillor in the review.
And said, all books about rural Minnesota, have to be graded against Garrison Keillor.
Yeah, and I think that was really unfortunate. And I don't think that was very...
It's unfair, really.
It's unfair. It's like, by all accounts, the author seems like a really cool guy. Everybody I've ever talked to says he's a really cool guy. So then to sort of lump him in with somebody who's going through a real public sort of struggle.
Yeah, exactly.
Potentially criminal kind of struggle. I don't know about that, how I felt about that.
Okay. So I was reading back through an interview you gave leading up to the Chippewa Valley Book Festival last fall, and you gave a shout out to your fifth grade teacher.
Yeah.
Who you said was one of the most influential people in your life, and the interviewer did not ask the obvious follow-up question. And I don't know whether it was just because it was an email interview or something, but I'm going to do that a few months later. What was so influential about your fifth grade teacher?
Yeah, Doug Smith. Shout out Doug Smith. And I know you've got some listeners who are also his student. So he was kind of an older gentleman when I had him as a teacher. He was probably grandfatherly age. He'd played semi-professional baseball with like Warren Spahn and Hank Aaron. And when I think about the expectations for 21st century school children like my kids versus what we experienced in his classroom, it's totally different. And his classroom was, and I'm not saying anything mean about my kids' teachers because I love them, but his teaching style was so different. He just read to us for long periods in the day, classics like, I think Ivanhoe was one, which is, that's like college level reading. And one of our projects during that year, fifth grade year I was with him, was we had to write a fictional account of the westward migration across America. We had all year to work on it, to research it. And most kids, I think, ended up around 25 to 40 pages, and mine ended up being 120 pages.
In fifth grade.
Yeah, in the fifth grade. Still one of the longer things I've written, by the way. And I think it's really amazing and sort of magical. If you give kids books and you give them stories and you give them time to write, what they'll do. And I think it's so hard to measure, right? We live in a society where increasingly we're pushing kids to have sort of practical jobs. So I don't have a practical job at all, and I think I contribute a fair amount to my community and to our state, I'd like to think, too, even. And I couldn't do that if I had a practical job. That's just not who I am, and he was the one who sort of filled me with some early confidence.
Well, I think we can all be grateful to Doug Smith.
Doug Smith, yeah, no doubt.
Everybody, shout out to Doug Smith. and we're grateful to you, Nick Butler. Oh. Thank you so much for coming to see us again, and we'll see you at Boswell Book Company.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Mitch.
Wisconsin writer Nick Butler's latest novel is called Little Faith. It comes out next week, and he and Mitch will reprise their conversation next Tuesday evening at Boswell Book Company. You can find more information about that at wuwm.com.